Hello, my friends, and welcome to Breathcast. My name is Mike Mayer. I'm your breathwork coach and host. And it's my job on this podcast to bring you a real wide variety of breath experts, because breathwork, it's really complex and there seems to be loads of contradictory things. But actually, when you boil it down, it's actually quite simple. But what I like to do is bring us lots of different experts, different opinions, different tips, different techniques, and understand what's going on so that you and I can start to implement tips, tricks, techniques to be healthier, happier, sleep better, live longer, and all that great stuff. And today I bring you Dr. Stephen Park. I love this podcast because he focuses on sleep. If I just pull up his a little bit of his resume to give you a little flavour. Author, speaker, former surgeon, board certified in sleep medicine, and best-selling book Sleep Interrupted, A Physician's Reveals the Number One Reason Why So Many of Us Are Sick and Tired. Now, just when you hear that title, you start to think, yeah, there's something going on there, isn't it? Because I feel quite tired all the time. Yeah, I'm getting sleep and all these different things. So we delve deep not only into breath, which obviously is my passion and the thing that we're here to talk about on Breathcast, but also the deep, strong connection that has with our sleep and how the two things are so interlocked. And if your sleep's off, then your diet's off, your exercise is off. You know, there's risks of all different things going on there. So we're really getting to that. So you're going to want to get yourself a nice cup of tea, get comfortable, and enjoy this wonderful conversation with Dr. Stephen Park. I just want to talk a little bit before we get stuck in just about a couple of things that's going on here at Take a Deep Breath. So if you haven't done so already, there's a link down below to 7 functional breathing exercises. It's a completely free PDF. You can get that straight away, and it links, if you use it on your computer, to all these different exercises I've got for free on my channel. And it just gives you the what, the why, and the how. So I encourage you to get that if you haven't got that already. Print it out, save it on your phone, on your computer. We've had really good feedback about that. The other thing that's going on here is the Level 1 Take a Deep Breath Foundations course is now live. And the feedback's just been absolutely incredible. So thank you so much to all those people that have bought the course. Let me be their digital breathwork coach and take them on that journey, that 5-week journey. Because, you know, again, if our breathing's off, our sleep's off, I'm not going to keep repeating that. But many of us have actually forgotten how to breathe, which I know sounds bonkers. You think, I've been breathing all my life. Why would I need you to teach me how to breathe? But we breathe too fast. We breathe too shallow. We breathe using the wrong holes. We create loads of extra stress in our lives. The way we breathe affects blood pressure, performance in the bedroom, anxiety, depression. It's all linked back to this breath. And so what I do over this online course, over these 5 weeks, I take you through step by step the what, the why, and the how. You can ask questions. There's homework, which I know doesn't sound that exciting, but it's quite cool homework. There's downloads. There's all sorts of stuff on there. So if you haven't done so already, I encourage you just to click the link and just have a bit of a read about all the other benefits that are on that course. But either way, free PDF or the course. And of course, on this YouTube channel, we've got over 200 breathing exercises on the Take a Deep Breath channel. So if you want to go over there and just practice some different breathing exercises, you can do all of that as well. And I want to introduce you now to Dr. Stephen Park. So have fun, enjoy this, take some notes, and hopefully off the back of this, you and I will improve our sleep percentages and our quality. Cheers. Ladies and gentlemen, we are here with Dr. Stephen Park. Dr. Park, thank you so much for being on Take a Deep Breath podcast. How are you doing today, first of all? How are you feeling?
I'm doing great. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, well, thank you for your time. I'm really excited about this. If you wouldn't mind, just for starters, could you just give people a little flavour about who you are and what your background is?
Sure. I'm an otolaryngologist, an ear, nose, and throat medicine and surgeon. But also later on in my career, I became board certified in sleep medicine. So I've been in practice for over 20 years. I'm currently in an academic teaching hospital in the Bronx in New York. And it's been a long journey. I think we're going to kind of talk about my journey as we talk about these topics that we're going to discuss today.
Mm, No, I'm really looking forward to getting stuck into that. So I guess, you know, it's always interesting. What made you choose that particular field? Because I guess in the field of medicine, there's so many areas you could have gone into. What made you choose this specific route?
So I think in retrospect, it was probably subconscious, because throughout my life, many of my own personal health issues from my parents were all related to ear, nose, and throat problems. So I, obviously I had, like lots of people, I've had nosebleeds. I broke my nose when I was 6 years old.
Right.
My father had major head trauma after being run over by a car. So The vast majority of our family medical problems were all related to ear, nose, and throat. But I also found ear, nose, and throat or otolaryngology very fascinating, because it's a very complex area with multiple different systems. Your nerves, your blood vessels, muscles, airway, breathing, swallowing, speaking, smell, taste, vision.
Yeah.
And very compact and dense amount of tissue. So it was very interesting anatomically. Mm. But then later on, I realized that because it's the pathway to breathing and eating and speaking, it influences your health and wellness in general. Because everything you breathe and you eat has to go through this area. But because you have to combine all three functions in this one common pathway, you get into problems. And that's some of the things that we're going to talk about later.
Yeah. Oh, yes. There's a lot going on, isn't there, in a very short space.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, fast. Right. So let's get stuck in. So I would like to get straight stuck into the nose, if you don't mind, because it's a fascinating thing. It was only a couple of years ago that I realized mouth breathing is not so good for you. And I might be being a bit gentle there. And because, you know, I think, well, you know, some people, you go to the gym and people are just panting away and you see people walking down the street. And so it was a bit of an awakening for me once I, you know, read James Ness's book, you know, Breath, spoke to Patrick McEwen and started to think, oh God, there's something not right here about all this mouth breathing. So I would love to, if we take it right back to the beginning and go, what is the benefits of nose breathing over mouth breathing? Would you give us a bit of a flavor of what's going on with some of that?
Well, let me give you an observation that I've made, particularly with marathon runners. If you look at all the last couple of marathon finish lines, and typically they're from African countries.
Right.
And there's some reasons for that, because their terrain, environment, their diets. But if you notice that every time there's a winner from an African country, when they're coming in the finish line, they're always coming in with their mouth closed, breathing through the nose. And they look really calm and relaxed. Whereas the Americans a couple of steps behind are always like with their mouths open.
Yeah.
And we know that people who breathe through the nose are much calmer. They have more energy, more focus. And that's been proven through multiple studies. And many of the guests you've had can attest to that. But number one, from a biochemical standpoint, the nose makes a gas called nitric oxide. It's very common knowledge among scientists, but this gas, which is a waste product, but when you breathe it into your lungs, it increases oxygen uptake by 10 to 20%.
Wow.
Because it dilates blood vessels in your lungs. And also, just as important, this gas kills bacteria, funguses, and viruses, and including the coronavirus and past epidemics. So it's a very important gas that you need for the body to function properly. So if you breathe through the mouth, you're bypassing this gas, plus you're also drying your saliva. And then when you open your mouth, anatomically, you would think that you would get more air in, but actually it gets worse. Mm. When you open your mouth, the tongue actually goes backwards. And you can see this when you do the endoscopy through the nose. It's pretty striking how much of a difference there is when you open your mouth versus closing your mouth.
So by just having your mouth open, you're making the airway smaller.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, wow. And for somebody like me, that's tongue-tied, and that's probably a whole other thing. Do I have the same problems? Or because my tongue's held forward, I'm just always curious, am I kind of not in that same group, or there still be a bit of the tongue that flies back as my mouth opens?
That's a huge topic to talk about, and it's somewhat controversial, and people have very strong opinions about this.
Oh, interesting.
My general philosophy is that this phenomenon of tongue tie or ankyloglossia that we're seeing much more of these days than in the past years, it's just the end product of whatever is happening that's causing our faces and their soft tissue not to develop fully. So it's not that the tongue tie causes jaw problems, the jaw problems cause tongue tie problems, but it's the, if you have this cascade of just whatever's happening up here, it cascades downwards, and you have multiple different factors, including soft tissue problems and jaw problems.
Mm.
So for some people, taking care of the tongue tie makes a huge difference. For some people, it makes no difference.
Right.
It depends on how many other factors you have going on.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. Cause I'm playing with the idea of having it sorted at the moment. Cause I'm nearly 40 and I've heard a few people say, you know, let's look at that. So we shall see. I wanted to ask you then, if we go back to nitric oxide, because, I've heard a few people talk about this now. Can you give me a bit, for somebody like me that hasn't got the medical background, can you give me a bit more kind of detail about what is nitric oxide? What's going on there and why are we producing it a bit more?
So the person that discovered this won the Nobel Prize, mm-hmm. I think in the 80s and 90s. It's a signaling molecule that relaxes blood vessels all throughout your body. And in some cases, if you have too much of it, it's toxic. Right. So just like everything else in the body, you have to have just the right amount in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
But when you mess with that physiology, then your body doesn't do too well.
Mm-hmm.
So this gas, in certain medical centers for the coronavirus, they're actually putting in artificial nitric oxide into the lungs through the endotracheal tube to dilate blood vessels.
Wow.
So it's a very common thing that we've known about for decades, but people don't take advantage of it because most people tend to breathe more through the mouth these days for various reasons that we're going to talk about.
Mm, mm. No, yeah, I'm looking forward to getting into that piece.
Yeah. Also, one more thing is that there are studies showing that if you hum, you increase nitric oxide production.
This is what I wanted to talk to you about before we went into the mouth and nose breathing. So Dr. Belfour, who we just spoke about before I hit record, I spoke to him. He's not been published on the channel yet, but he was really passionate about nitric oxide. And he was telling me when you do box breathing, for example, for those that don't know, you know, it's the in, the pause, and the out, and the pause, and you do a count to that. He was saying when you do the out breath, use the mouth because you're letting the nitric oxide build up even more. And then when you go in for the next in-breath, all that nitric oxide's been kind of, you know, held there and you get a bit more. Whereas if you'd breathed out through the nose, you might have blown off some of that nitric oxide. So I don't know if there's anything to that or you've got anything else you can add to that. Like, should we be humming? Should we be trying in our day to kind of produce more nitric oxide? Hello, my friends. I just wanted to pause this wonderful conversation just to remind you again about the Functional Breathing Essentials course, the Level 1 Take a Deep Breath course that helps you get your foundation of breathing right. There's loads of cool, sexy breathing exercises out there, isn't there? We can huff and puff and do all this cool stuff and create different states. But actually, if your foundation's off and you're already stressed all day, do you really want to do another stressful exercise? You know, people go for a walk and the mouth opens as they go up a hill or up the stairs, and we start breathing through our mouth, losing moisture, creating stress, creating anxiety, raising blood pressure. And so if that sounds like you, or you know somebody that could benefit from just learning very simple techniques, your body wants to breathe the way it was intended to breathe. It knows how to breathe. It can get back there again. And I just help nudge that along with my 5 years worth of kind of research and knowledge in this field of breath work. You know, over 125,000 subscribers on the Take a Deep Breath channel, 50 million views, 50 interviews with top breathing experts. I'm mad if I didn't see the same patterns over and over again about we've got to get the functional breathing bang on, because if that's off, everything's off, sleep's off, diet's off, exercise is off. So it really all starts with our breath, and I encourage you just to click the link below and have a look at our Functional Breathing course, Level 1. Okay, back to the Breathcast. Thank you.
Well, I think there's some truth to that. You want to be naturally breathing in through your nose, and the nitric oxide has to go into the lungs. But remember, the nose is not just to produce nitric oxide.
Mm.
It's a filter processing, air processing system that helps us smooth, warm, humidify, and filter air. It's a pre-processor for the air that you breathe into your lungs.
Mm.
So, and also allows for laminar airflow. So instead of tumbling airflow, it's very smooth.
Mm.
The nose is a very important part of the whole breathing process and your physiology. So I think that Dr. Belfour may have a point that you don't want to breathe out the nitric oxide. You want to just inhale it as much as possible.
Yeah.
But honestly, ideally, you want, when you talk about breathing, I know that's a big focus of your show and maybe your guests, and we can override our breathing and improve our health. But ideally, you don't want to be thinking about breathing. It should be natural, right? But because we kind of mess everything up through our environment and our diet, now we have to kind of think about it to be able to breathe better. And so I think these are all very important concepts to talk about. But ideally, you want to get to the point where either naturally or just because of habit, it's a natural breathing process as opposed to trying to do it artificially or override.
Mm. Yeah, because there is that difference, isn't there, between conscious breath work and functional breathing. And they're two different things, really. I know there's an overlap there, but you're right. There's that 25 to 35,000 times a day where you really shouldn't be thinking about it, I guess, like you say. But then there's times where you might want to do some Wim Hof stuff or, you know, some nice slow stuff. Okay. And so let's jump in then to mouth, nose, and this problem that's out there now. Why are so many people, and this is a huge question, why are so many people mouth breathing and what are the problems with that?
Okay. So let me tell you another story. So a couple of years ago, we went to the Bahamas for vacation and we went outside the main area to the zoo and we were watching these dancing flamingo show. It was very interesting. And next to us was a group of school-age children. I think they were in the fourth, fifth grade. And I was shocked to see 25 fourth graders sitting all together, completely calm, with their mouth closed and paying attention, not one bit of noise or talking. Now, you're not going to see that in the United States. I don't know about where you are.
Same, yeah.
Yeah, that was really surprising. And because they're all breathing through their mouths.
Mm.
If you look at most school-age children these days, I would say half, if not majority, are breathing through the mouths. And they're fidgeting and they can't focus, they can't pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an epidemic that we're seeing that's getting worse and worse. Now, let me put things in perspective. We just did a study, we're trying to get this published. We analyzed 12,000 college yearbook faces from the 1930s compared to now. And we used computer analysis to measure width versus height ratio because we can't do absolute values. And modern faces are by far much more narrow and taller. So something is happening in our environment. It's not from our genes, because we've had pretty good teeth for millennia up until recently in the past 100 years due to the modern Western diets. And so the theory is that, and this is something that was brought to light by Dr. Weston Price in his book, very classic book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. He was a dentist that traveled the world in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at all these indigenous cultures throughout five continents. And across the board, whenever they ate naturally with no artificial food or sugar, they had perfect teeth, no crowding, they were perfectly healthy, no cavities.
Wow.
But then when they started to adopt Western diets, within one generation, their kids had more cavities, more narrow arches, more sickly, more prone to infectious diseases.
Mm.
And so the thought is that when you go from eating naturally hard foods off the ground, chewing a lot, going from that to processed foods and refined sugar with no fiber, you need a lot of muscular action to allow the jaws to form. One of my mentors in dental school, Dr. Melvin Moss, I think he's very famous in the dental field what's called the spatial matrix theory, that the jaws don't grow on their own. They're not grown due to the genes. They grow because of the soft tissue and the muscular action. So they don't grow, they're grown by how you use your mouth.
Yeah.
So because of the change in our diets, but also modern societies also tend to have much more bottle feeding than breastfeeding. And in the dental literature, it's pretty good evidence showing that bottle feeding aggravates more crooked teeth and what's called malocclusion. And then you add thumb sucking, pacifier use, these non-nutritive sucking forces alters the way your mouth forms.
Mm.
And then they've also shown that just plugging people's noses causes the face not to form properly either over time.
Yeah.
And then there's probably another 10 or 20 other reasons that kind of contribute. For example, I'm going to propose that even fluoride in our drinking water could potentially cause this problem too, because if you think about the rationale for adding fluoride to the water system is to harden your teeth so you don't get cavities. But is the fluoride just going to your teeth only? Or is it going to all the other bones in your body to prematurely harden them?
Oh, wow, that's terrifying. That's absolutely terrifying. I've not heard that before about the fluoride. I was thinking, we spoke about our dogs very briefly before we hit record. And I was just thinking, you know, we know dogs need to chew. So one of the most common things that you buy a dog is a chew toy, or you buy them these dentist sticks. And so it's very accepted that dogs need to chew. And if they don't, they get a bit funny, and it's really important for the jaws. But it really doesn't feel like that's common knowledge for us. And you know, we spoke about Dr. Mike Mew before, but you know, I know he says sit up straight and chew your food, shut your mouth and chew your food. But I'm one of these people that just, you know, ate my food as quick as I could as a kid, a couple of bites and get it down. What is it? Are we learning bad, you know, kind of observations from our parents? Where is this coming from? This kind of, I know part of it's the food, the types of food we're eating, but isn't it part of the posture as well and some other things? Where are these bad habits coming from that we're kind of taking, do you think?
A lot of it is culture, technology, obviously, in these modern times. You're just rushed to go do work or surf the net. But also technology, not just technology, modern technology, but technology in the old days, for example, hundreds of years ago, for example, forks and knives were new technology. That was like a landmark. If you had forks and knives, you were rich and you were well to do. And there's a really fascinating book I read a couple of years ago by Bea Wilson called Consider the Fork. And she talked about the history of culinary technology. The fascinating chapter on overbites. And what she noted was that she studied this dentist named Dr. Brace, who studied tons of skulls, historical skulls. And what he discovered was that before like 300 to 400 years ago, people did not have crooked teeth as much. And they had what's called the edge-to-edge bite, where the incisors are meeting edge-to-edge. But then about 200 to 300 years ago, they started to have this, where they have an overbite. And what he found was that this happened first with rich people, the aristocracy, people who had access to knives and forks, and that across the board in England and even in China. Actually, what happened earlier in China, because they had these cutting knives, I think they call it a tao, it's like a butcher knife, they use it to cut everything. So when you chop up meat and vegetables before you start eating, that lessens the amount of work you have to do. But now everyone has an overbite. Definition.
Yeah, I was just thinking about where my teeth were as you were saying that. I was like, yeah, there's an overbite there. And can you know if adults have got this problem where they've chewed poorly and they've not eaten the right food and they've had lots of sugar and then their faces have changed, would that get passed on to their children, or if their children were born and then did everything properly, would they be okay? Is it being passed through the generations or not? Do you know?
That's a really interesting question. I've thought about this quite a bit. You know, maybe 10, 20 years ago, I would have thought it's genetic, but the more I learn about these, the more I'm realizing it's more environmental. So it's the epigenetics rather than your genes.
Yes.
Your genes give you a possible range of possible expressions, a range of expressions, but your environment determines where you are on this continuum. So obviously kids kind of, you get your parents' genes, you kind of look at your parents. But you have to realize that your children also grow up in the same environment that your adults are exposed to. Same kind of culture, same habits, same foods. I mean, I could even argue that adopted children will start to kind of adopt same habits and have the same features as they get older. Obviously, the younger they start out, the more chance that they're going to be very similar to their parents. That's why we have all these fields now that can help to modify these factors anatomically. It's not just due to your genes. And I think they've shown the same thing with all the medical conditions too, like cancer, diabetes, heart disease. Yes, the genes are important, but the environment is more important.
Okay, that's interesting. Why do you think the mouth is there as this backup air supply? Because it's obviously being misused at the minute, isn't it, with us? But why do you think it exists in the first place, the ability to go to mouth?
Well, whenever your nose gets stuffy, for example, if you have allergies, you're going to breathe through your mouth. If you have a deviated septum, let me diverge a little bit. Now, a deviated septum is when the nasal septum, which is the middle partition of your nose. It's one midline structure made of cartilage and bone. It's crooked like this and swimming like this. So going back to the facial development, if the hard palate, which is like this, if it doesn't drop during development, so when you're born, it's more like this. And during development with proper training, it should drop properly like this. So notice how the molars widen and your jaws get wider and bigger and forward. But if the roof of your mouth doesn't drop properly, the septum, as it grows, it just buckles to one side.
Right.
So that's why you get the deviated septum. Also, the nasal cavity is more narrow because it follows your molars. So your mid-face follows your jaws. And lastly, the angle between your septum and your nostril, the flimsy part, is more narrow like this. So it tends to cave in much easier, like sucking through a flimsy straw. So you have a more narrow nasal cavity, a deviated septum, flimsier nostrils. And on top of that, if you add inflammation that causes your membranes to swell up, then you got a stuffy nose, and that'll reflexively cause you to open your mouth. And so there are anatomic reasons why you're going to do this. There are inflammatory reasons like allergies, even neurologic problems. So a lot of people also have neurologic issues, meaning that, for example, sinus migraines can give you nasal congestion. So not just a headache, but a migraine of the nose and sinuses can give you congestion, especially on one side. And also, if you don't sleep well, it this causes this physiologic state of stress that alters your involuntary nervous system. So your nervous system, not just your nose, but your entire body overreacts to your environment, weather changes, chemical scents, perfumes, odors, and smoke. And so all these factors contribute to causing nasal congestion. I'm going to add one more thing. Many people who are on high blood pressure medications, by definition, they will have nasal congestion. Because if you dilate blood vessels to lower your blood pressure, you're also dilating the blood vessels in your nose, which are very vascular. Especially called the turbinates, the turbines, they're like wings that help to smooth and warm and humidify the air. When that swells up, you're going to have more nasal congestion. And I see this all the time in my practice, where I see people with high blood pressure on medications. And when I give a decongestant spray to take a look with the camera, people who are not on blood pressure medications, they shrink really quickly within seconds to maybe a minute or so. But the people on high blood pressure medications, it takes many more minutes to decongest. It just doesn't decongest as well as you would expect if you spared someone that didn't have high blood pressure medications. So you end up breathing through your mouth, but this goes back to your question. Whenever I do surgery to open up the nose, the vast majority start to breathe through the nose again. But there's a few percent of people, maybe 3 to 5%, or even up to 10%, where even though they're wide open, they still breathe through the mouth because they've done this for their lifetime. And so these people need help, you know, with the myofunctional therapist and speech and therapist to relearn how to breathe through the nose.
Ooh, I'm looking forward to asking you about mouth tape in a minute and how that works. Yeah, I just thought, so do you know, I've taken decongestant many times in my life when I've had a cold. And I actually got, I remember about 10 years ago, I got a bit addicted to it because there was this kind of, you take it, you can breathe amazing, and then you get this kind of backlog that comes back later. But I never once asked, even now doing this breathcast, what is decongestant? What's it doing to us? Yeah.
So there are topical decongestants and pill form decongestants. So the common ingredients you see are what's called oxymetazoline or phenylephrine. The brand names are going to be Afrin, Dristan. I don't know what it is in your country. But then you also have the Sudafed, the pill form, which is pseudoephedrine. And they both help to constrict blood vessels. Now, the problem with the decongestant sprays is that you get a rebound effect. So it works amazingly well, but if you keep using it, the effect gets shorter and shorter, so you have to use it more and more often. So people get addicted to it after using it for more than three or four days. That's why they say never to use it for more than a couple of days. But I actually use it to get people to see what it's like to breathe through the nose. They have no idea what normal breathing is. So I have them do it just for a couple of days, along with allergy medications, and even add breathe right trips to kind of stiffen your nostrils to get them a sense of what it's like to breathe better through the nose. And so you have to be careful with these decongestants. And it's, you know, even the on the bottle, it says do not use for more than 3 days, but most people end up using it for weeks or months. So I have a lot of patients that come in who are hooked on these medications.
Yeah. And if they are, so if there's somebody watching this now and they're like, that's me, I've been doing it for weeks now or months, how can they get off it? Because it's quite panicky, because you might stop taking it and you feel like you just can't breathe. So any suggestions how you wean yourself off?
So my typical protocol, honestly, it's going to be really hard to come off of it naturally. So the way I do it medically is put someone on nasal steroid spray to calm the inflammation. And also you can use Sudafed, the decongestant pill, for a couple of days to kind of take over the effect of the decongestant spray. Mm. But oftentimes if it's really bad, I'll give a very short course of oral steroids along with the topical steroids, and that usually wins them off. But typically these people are going to need nasal surgery because they have a really bad deviated septum. Mm. So it's a structural problem that just manifested as becoming addicted to Afrin or decongestants.
Okay. And what about things like menthol, like Olbass oil, Vicks vapor rub, those sort of things? Are they just a milder, more natural form of the decongestants, or is there something else going on with those?
Yeah. So you have all these sprays or bottles or various formulas to help you decongest your nose. And especially with menthol, it's interesting. They did studies on this. They measured nasal airflow resistance using this meter and also subjective improvement. Very interesting findings. What they found was that with menthol, subjectively, patients felt much better, but objectively, there was no difference. And the theory is that it causes this cooling effect, so you feel like you're breathing better.
Yeah. Oh, no, I think you've just blown the placebo away for me, maybe.
Sorry.
Sometimes it's better not to know. But yeah, I just thought that because, yeah, I actually became a bit addicted to that as well. I was like, oh, it's lovely, because you do it a couple of times a day and you suddenly feel like you can breathe better. But yeah, there's a cooling effect. That's fascinating.
I was disappointed too when I found that.
I'll try and forget that bit. Okay, so if we go back then to kind of mouth breathing and nasal breathing, so if you've helped somebody then and you've opened up their airways and they're still going to mouth, what sort of things should they be doing, or do you do with them to teach them to be a nose breather again?
I think you mentioned this before, mouth taping, and it's basically, it's really become much more popular these days and much more accepted. And many years ago, I was skeptical myself, but now I've turned completely the other side. I do it myself when I sleep.
Okay.
So the key is, if you go to mouth tape, you have to make sure you're breathing well through your nose. So focus on your nose first. And once you get to a regimen where it works for you, where you can breathe through your nose regularly, especially at night, then you can talk about mouth taping. Now, there's some logistical issues with mouth taping. You, for example, if you have a beard or a mustache, it's hard to tape. And most people would say you tape your lips together. And so that does work. But my issue with that is that if you put your lips together, you can still open your mouth a lot. So again, when I take a look at the camera, when people are sleeping through the nose, I take a look at that space behind the tongue. When you open your mouth even this much, there's a big difference. It gets much more narrow. So the key is not to keep your lips together, but to keep your jaws closed. So the two ways that you can do this is to use a chin strap. And you can find this for people who snore or people who have to keep their mouth closed for using CPAP. But the issue with these straps is that they're elastic and you can still open your mouth a lot. Despite, it just kind of suggests to keep your mouth closed, but you can still open your mouth. So what I've been recommending is to do vertical taping, to go under the nose, to go under the jaw, to kind of suspend the jaws, to keep your jaws closed, but you can still open your lips if you want to. You can breathe out through the corners if you want to. And I always have them make sure to put a tab at the end so you can grab it to pull off easily. But I've been doing this for the past 2 or 3 months, and I know I feel much better, along with my breathe right strips. We didn't talk about that, but anything you can do to improve your nostrils from caving in, whether it's from externally or internally, you can use these gadgets, devices. You can find like 50 different options online. So you kind of have to experiment to see what you can tolerate, what works for you. So I think with a lot of people, if you use something to open your nostrils and keep your mouth closed, that'll probably help conservatively about 20 to 30% significantly. another quarter will get some improvement, and the rest will get almost no improvement. That means they need more help professionally.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because I'm really looking forward to talking about sleep as well. So when you've started with the mouth taping, have you tracked it with like an Oura ring, or is it just how you feel the next day? Have you got any kind of measurements on differences of sleep?
Ultimately, what's most important is subjective. These gadgets like the Oura ring, you know, all these sleep tracking apps on the phones, they're very useful. But the problem is that it just gives you too much data. You have to kind of interpret the data compared to how you're feeling. And sometimes you kind of override how you feel based on what the data is telling you.
Yes.
And so my philosophy over the years is to kind of not dismiss these data points, but to just take everything more with a grain of salt. Even the formal sleep studies, I'm beginning to put less and less value on it now, because it only measures certain predefined variables. So let me give you an example. If you take a sleep study in a sleep lab, to have a diagnosis of sleep apnea, you need at least 5 apneas per hour to say you have sleep apnea. And apnea means you stop breathing completely for 10 seconds or longer.
Right.
And hypopneas are more than 50% obstructed breathing for more than 10 seconds with your oxygen dropping more than 3 or 4%. So very technical definitions. But both these definitions means that you stop breathing for more than 10 seconds. And you need 5 episodes per hour minimum to say you have sleep apnea. But let's say that you stop breathing 25 times an hour for 9 seconds each. Then your score is going to be 0.
Right.
And you're told you don't have sleep apnea, you're fine.
Wow.
That's the problem with technology. You put in certain variables, it spits out only what you're looking for while ignoring everything else.
Yes.
So the same thing with these consumer apps and devices, it's helpful. But ultimately, what's more important is how you feel than what the number tells you. Because you end up trusting the numbers and then you get misled.
Yeah, because I've been playing with the Oura Ring for a couple of weeks now. And it is very interesting. But sometimes it'll give you a high score and you think, oh, I'm quite tired. It's interesting that it said I've had... And then other times it's telling me that my deep sleep is not good enough. So it is interesting. But I can see if you did that for months and months... I'm not sure where I'd go with the data, but no, that so it's how you feel. Sorry. Well,
let me add one more thing. So that technology is just, it's been around for 100 years.
Right.
It's called actigraphy. And so we've been using, it's basically a motion detector, right? That's all it is. And so we've had tons of studies in sleep medicine showing that there's some good correlation with sleep, but it's not that precise. And it doesn't correlate with subjective sensation as much as objective measurements, like brain waves. So it's just more convenient now because everyone has access to it. And obviously there's a marketing aspect to it as well. That's why you're seeing these inconsistencies. That's the first comment I get when patients use these devices is, oh, it's not always accurate. Sometimes it's widing off.
Yeah.
But if you're going to use it as a, look at it on like 30 days at a time, not just day by day. So as a big overall picture, as opposed to micro-analyzing every day of the night or at night.
Yeah, but I think you're right. There is that piece around how you feel. It's so important and making sure that you're kind of in touch with yourself. I think the same with like yoga or stretching. It's that moment of kind of checking in with your body, isn't it? And seeing how do I actually feel? Oh, I didn't know that there was some tightness here and stuff, but we're so busy sometimes that we don't have the opportunity to do that, or we don't allow. So if we can just jump into sleep a little bit, and we can probably jump back into breath. Where do you stand on things like light blockers and, you know, red lights and all that sort of stuff?
But there's so many different ways of improving your sleep quality via what's called sleep hygiene. There's a whole list of sleep hygiene techniques you can do. Modern technology, and this started 100 years ago with the light bulb, it completely messed up our sleep rhythms, our circadian rhythms, because when it's dark, when the sun comes down, usually you light up the room with fire, right? Which is this, you know, reddish, orangish light, very warm colors on the spectrum. Now, what they've shown is that blue light from the incandescent lights, or not just incandescent, but especially fluorescent, and especially the LED screens now from computers and smartphones, it lowers your melatonin sleep hormone. So let's say that you want to go to sleep at 10 o'clock, starting 8 p.m., so 2 hours before you naturally want to fall asleep, melatonin starts to go up. So if you're watching TV or using a computer before that time, it's going to delay the onset of melatonin. And so that's going to lower your sleep quality. That's why people recommend using a blue blocker, glasses, or you can change the settings on the software on your screen to make it more blue, make it more warm colors. But my argument is that's kind of a cover up. Why not just not do it altogether?
Right.
Because most stuff on the internet is very exciting or disturbing. So, you know, not just the lights, but also the content is very stimulating or disturbing.
And
one other interesting thing that I just learned recently is that melatonin is not just a sleep hormone. That's the one thing about hormones. It's not just one thing like thyroid and metabolism. Every hormone has 100 different functions that we don't talk about. We just label it with one function. So melatonin is thought to be the sleep hormone, but it has another important function. It's an anti-reflux hormone. So it helps to lower acid secretion in your stomach.
Okay.
It also helps to tighten your lower esophageal sphincter.
Oh, okay. So is that why if you have alcohol and you go to bed really tired and your melatonin's low, you get more acid reflux maybe because it's not been able to shut that down properly?
Right. That's one aspect. But the other tip that I tell all my patients, this is the most important tip for everyone, especially for the audience, is do not eat or snack within 3 to 4 hours of bedtime. And the reason is that the more stomach juices you have, the more it comes up just either passively, or since everyone has some kind of sleep breathing problem, we'll get into that a little later. My theory that I read about in my book, Sleep Interrupted, is that all modern humans, because of our crowded teeth, are susceptible to sleep breathing problems to various degrees. And many won't have sleep apnea. And so if you stop breathing just once in a while, that's not considered sleep apnea. Imagine bringing up small amounts of acid 4 times into your throat, which causes inflammation, swelling. And they've actually shown that stomach juices can reach your nose, sinuses, ears, and your lungs. They've actually found pepsin in these areas, which is a digestive enzyme. And that's also why when you take these reflux medications, it helps a little bit, you feel better, but it's not treating the reflux. What it's doing instead is it's lowering acid secretion, but it's not doing anything for reflux. So what comes up is still irritating because of the enzymes and bacteria and the food particles.
So it gets all the way up. That's incredible. I've suffered with it for years, and actually not having food hours before bed was one of the biggest game changers for me. And not only that, just better sleep, you know, because you're not digesting all that food and you're able to just get off and have a more restful night. And I can tell if I go out for a late meal, it's a terrible night's sleep. Even if there's no alcohol involved, it's awful.
Alcohol is different for different reasons because it relaxes your muscles. So a lot of people depend on alcohol to fall asleep because they get drowsy. But because it relaxes your muscles, your sleep quality goes down dramatically because you stop breathing more.
Yeah, your deep sleep really gets affected, doesn't it, by that? Yeah. Let's talk a bit about the book then. So it's sleep problems, breathing sleep problems. Is that what it specializes in?
Right, Sleep Interrupted. And I go through the reasons why all modern humans have these issues. And I kind of link various common health conditions like ADHD, dementia, heart disease, anxiety, depression, cancer, to sleep breathing problems. And I cite all the references.
Okay. And so to give people a bit of a flavor then. So what is, obviously we've talked about mouth tape. Is the stuff to do with the side that we sleep on, you know, the type of bed we've got? What sort of things are causing some of these problems? Or is it day breathing? I'm sure there's a whole host of things here. It'd be lovely to hear your thoughts.
That's a really good segue into sleep position.
Okay.
That's so important. And I have a chapter in my book about that. So let me give you a story. So about once or twice a month, typically I'll see a middle-aged woman, like let's say late 40s, who comes in with, let's say, 6 weeks of sinus infections, headaches, misery, fatigue, anxiety, and they're given multiple courses of antibiotics by the medical doctor. It doesn't help. And what I find is that what they're suffering from is a sinus migraine. Not a headache, but the nerve endings in the sinuses are just overreactive.
Right.
And so I asked them, do you sleep on your backside or stomach? And she says, I sleep on my back. And I don't believe her because she has a tiny mouth. So I ask her, when you were a teenager, how'd you sleep? On my stomach. Well, when did you change? Maybe about 7 or 8 weeks ago. Well, why did you change? My dermatologist told me, don't sleep on your face. Don't sleep on your stomach because it causes wrinkles on your face. So then I started sleeping on my back. So I can argue that sleeping on your back for these women will cause more wrinkles because they're not sleeping. And the same thing happens, for example, if you get injured. Like I'm assuming that you probably, just based on your history, you probably don't like to sleep on your back either, right?
No.
Yeah.
No.
So imagine if you got injured or underwent an operation and you are forced to sleep on your back.
Yes.
You're in big trouble.
Yes. Yeah. It's I have some back spasms from an old injury, an old sporting injury. And every now and again, it will flare up. And the only place I can sleep to stop the spasm is on my back. And I've had to do this twice, maybe three times in the last 4 years. Awful sleep, because the spasms last for about 10 days. And so I'm just on my back and I just can't get any sleep. It's awful. Yeah. Snoring, all sorts of things. Yeah.
Due to gravity, everything falls back more when the muscles are relaxed.
And would the tongue tightness also be a problem for that as well, then, in theory, potentially?
Well, if you could look at the tongue anatomy, if you look from the side, the tip of the tongue is pointing this way. Down here at the bottom base of the tongue is your voice box, but the epiglottis like this and the vocal cords like right here. So if you look at the base of the tongue in the floor of the mouth, it tethers right up here. So loosening this is not going to change. This is the part that falls back, not the tip of the tongue.
Right.
It's a different anatomic area. And I see this when I examine patients in the operating room. It's not the tip that falls back. It's the base of the tongue that falls back, because the base is connected to the lower jaw and what's called the hyoid bone, which is the C-shaped bone right here. So like a direct line, jawbone, hyoid bone, epiglottis, and tongue base right here. Right. So this is what falls back.
Okay. So really, being tongue-tied doesn't really affect that bit at all. It can still fall back or not.
Well, it can indirectly.
Right.
Like I said, in some people, it makes a dramatic difference in their sleep quality. It's more because they can get mobility. The tongue gets it higher up in the touching the hard palate. So that's also important too. That's probably more effect is that the tongue is able to sit on the roof of the mouth as opposed to having an open like this.
Oh wow, okay. So we've talked a lot about kind of the problems and you know, some of the factors that have caused it. I'd love to hear your thoughts on how people can get better. You know, what are some of the practical things we can do? So if we've got sleep problems, or we're mouth breathing, or we've got really bad, you know, crooked teeth, what are some of the solutions that people can look into?
Sure. I mean, I have about 4 or 5 simple tips you can start on your own. And the rest, you're going to need some medical help, whether it's a dentist or breathing specialist or a myofunctional therapist or even a doctor. But we mentioned a couple before, don't eat within 3 to 4 hours of bedtime. No snacks, nothing that's going to simulate extra acid. You can drink a little water, but not too much water. Speaking of water, a lot of people with these issues will also wake up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. And the reason for this is that every time you stop breathing, you stretch your heart. The heart thinks that there's too much blood coming in because the chambers get dilated. So it produces a hormone called atrionatriuretic peptide that goes to your kidneys and make you pee more than usual.
Oh.
So when you wake up, it's around the same time every night. If it's one time, it's around maybe 3 a.m.-ish. But if you wake up more than once, it's about 90 to 120 minutes apart. So you wake up at the same time intervals. That's one sleep cycle. When you go into REM sleep, when you're dreaming, that's when your muscles relax. So that's why you should limit the amount of water you drink before you go to bed if you have these issues. Just drink your water earlier in the day and go to the bathroom before you go to bed. And then we talk about no alcohol close to bedtime. So alcohol is okay, but have it early, but in moderation. And you know, they talked about the health benefits of a glass of red wine also. And then the other thing is you have to enter your stomach, optimize your nasal breathing. These are the two things that we talked about. How to do the nasal optimization. Now, I'm an ENT surgeon. This is the most common operation I do to improve nasal breathing, to improve people's sleep quality. And a lot of my patients also have sleep apnea, and the treatment for sleep apnea requires either a mouth guard or a CPAP machine or dental appliances. But for all these options to work properly, you need to have an open nose so you can keep your mouth closed. Okay. So go through all the steps we talked about, you know, with the breathing techniques, you can also do nasal saline that helps to decongest temporarily, the breathe right trips, these internal dilator devices. But ultimately, if you have really crooked teeth, that by definition, you're going to have a deviated septum. So that's not going to change with all these methods. So you have to see an ENT and then get that taken care of. But one of the reasons why nasal surgery or septoplasty doesn't help some people is that you didn't address your nostrils. So that's something that I always look for to make sure the nostrils are not caving in. So let's say that you get better nasal breathing and then you empty your stomach. Now, the reason why I focus on these two things to start with is based on the research study I saw about 20 years ago. This kind of opened my eyes to this whole field. There was a study looking at snorers, heavy snorers, and they gave them Sudafed, which is a decongestant that we talked about, a decongestant pill, and also a medication to help empty the stomach faster, called domperidone, which we don't have in this country. I think some countries still have it. It's very cheap. So when they did the domperidone and the Sudafed, something like 80 to 90% had significant resolution in their snoring, and they felt much better.
Wow.
Now, they didn't test for sleep apnea, but I bet you it probably helped the sleep apnea somewhat also. Because remember, what this does is by keeping your nose more open and the stomach empty, you have less reflux and you keep your mouth closed.
Yeah.
That's the basic foundation for all my patients, no matter what they come in for. I think that should be basic for any doctor's visit. If you come in for high blood pressure, pain, whatever it is, you have to breathe well through your nose and go to bed on the empty stomach.
Yeah.
And we also talked about limiting bright lights before bedtime. Sleep position, make sure that you're sleeping in your preferred sleep position. Don't let them tell you that sleeping on your back is healthy. It is to a certain degree. It's better for your spine. But if you can't breathe properly, that takes precedence.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then at a certain point, you have to see if you have allergies that can cause congestion. You have to get some professional help. Just their over-the-counter medications and then their prescription medications. Many people with these issues will need some kind of dental therapy for braces or palatal expansion or appliance therapy. And then ENT can help with the nasal surgery. Some kids and adults will have huge tonsils. And that's, they're called kissing tonsils, that like golf balls inside your airway like this. It's pretty dramatic when you see it.
Yeah.
And so there's lots of different ways you can handle this, and there's no one right way. My recommendation is, doesn't matter which one you choose, start with one and then just move on to the next if it doesn't get better.
That's really helpful. That's really good advice. As you were saying that, I was just thinking, what role does the CO2 tolerance play for you and your patients in this? Do you do anything with that at all in terms of slow nasal breathing exercises? Because I know, I guess with the mouth taping, I'm assuming the reason you're advising that and you're doing that is for your CO2 tolerance, as well as keeping it, physically it's closed and you're using the mouth. I guess it's bringing up that. So is there anything else that people you would recommend or you've looked at in terms of CO2 tolerance?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot been written about that, and Patrick talks about that a lot in his book. Honestly, it's a very useful concept that makes a lot of sense. Clinical practice, in my practice, I don't have a way of applying it because I don't have the technology. I don't have the instruments to measure that. The only time I see it is during sleep studies. So you see that people who have what's called hypoventilation, especially in kids, they don't expand their lungs as much as they should be because they're partially blocked up here. And so there's carbon dioxide levels go up. But what ends up happening is most of these kids will have low carbon dioxide levels because they're hyperventilating during the daytime.
Right.
And it's high at night and low during the daytime. But going back to the whole nasal breathing and the mouth issue, another milestone for me was Dr. Andrew Weil. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's a very famous integrative alternative physician. He just passed away a couple of years ago. I came across one of his audiobooks called Breathing, the Key to Optimal Health, or something like that. And he talks about the relaxing breath, which is taught in yoga. And there's lots of variations of this. And when you breathe in through your nose, hold for 4 or 5 seconds, and then exhale twice as long through your mouth. So see, it's the same concept that's been around for thousands of ages, thousands of years, right? And so that's going to it's going to lower your carbon dioxide. It's going to raise your carbon dioxide because you're not breathing in. You're going to hold on to your carbon dioxide. And then Patrick talks about how it alters your blood pH levels yeah. and how your oxygen gets released from blood cells. So there are physiologic reasons why these concepts work. Mm-hmm. My job as an airway surgeon is to facilitate breathing by opening up the blockages. So I'm like a fancy plumber for breathing.
I think that's quite it's tickled me a bit. The house, it just made me think. When you talk about airways, is there any link between all of these things we've just spoke about? You know, the poor breathing, the poor chewing, and an increase in people choking and getting food stuck, or is that just come down to I've just chewed my food too fast and I did something wrong, or is there a higher link there?
Okay. Let me back up a little bit. I talked about this in my book where. Developmentally, when you're born in infants, if this is the soft palate and this is the voice box down here, the soft palate and the epiglottis overlaps in infants. So the voice box is high up, high up in the throat. That's when you look inside a child's mouth, you can see the tip of the epiglottis, the voice box tip. And then during development, around 3 to 4 months, it starts to separate down and the voice box descends from behind your tongue to underneath your tongue, like this. So you get this space called the oral pharynx. This is called laryngeal descent. Now, up here, this is why infants can breathe and suckle at the same time. And they're obligate nose breathers. So everything was kind of designed to work perfectly until the development happens. And then once this develops, the larynx descends, that unprotects the airway.
Right.
And that's why, and then if you look at chimpanzees and human infants, it's very similar like this, but the adults, it's like this. And that's when people start to have choking and swallowing problems. The laryngeal descent unprotected the airway because this airway has to serve all three functions now, swallowing, speaking, and breathing. So you don't see animals choking often, unlike humans.
Yeah.
Then now that we have smaller mouths, more inflammation, and all these other factors cause the neurologic problems, we're having more swallowing and choking problems.
Yeah.
Which is really sad to see.
Yeah. So it's not just I chewed my food too quickly and swallowed it when it was too big. There is actually something potentially going on there with the actual airway, the strength of the muscles in the airways maybe as well, and food getting stuck. Right. Wow. Okay. Yeah.
So anatomically, we're all predisposed to choking. Everyone has that episode of choking once in their life, once in their lives. But what I'm suggesting is that our eating habits, eating quicker because we're rushed, not sitting down and chewing as much as we should be and having good conversations, not using your phone while you're eating. Our habits, even though the food is softer, we're not chewing because it's softer, we don't have time to chew. Because when you chew, you produce more saliva, more enzymes in the mouth and the stomach. So that whole process, it's a ritual that you have to follow, otherwise things go wrong.
Yeah, yeah. I've never connected choking and breathing before. That makes common sense. What do your routines look like? What does your, because you talked about the mouth taping. Do you use any chewing devices? Can you share a little bit about maybe your morning and nighttime routines? Do you do any different kind of breathing exercises? I'd just love to know a bit about what you as the doctor do personally.
I follow everything that I recommended, not eating late. Yeah. I mean, sometimes you can't help it. But I do breathe at trips. I do mouth taping. I exercise regularly. And when I do, I breathe through my nose as much as I prefer. Personally, I can't sleep on my side because my arm hurts. So what I do instead is when I sleep on my back, I position my neck backwards. So this, you have these contour pillows. You can make like a roll type pillow, or you can use these husk filled pillows to extend your neck back, and that'll help to open up your airway more. So that's why you see these pillows for snoring, these contour pillows where it's higher here and lower here. So, I mean, I try to practice what I preach with my patients. So it's not just breathing, but along with good breathing, it's also what you eat. So that's just as important as breathing, if not. Yeah, well, breathing is more important, obviously. And then if you don't sleep well, you don't feel well. And if you don't sleep well, it's hard to lose weight. Preferentially, you're going to crave unhealthy, sugary, fatty foods. So when you start to learned about better breathing, it naturally leads you into these all these other areas of health and wellness. So anything to help calm your nervous system, the meditation, relaxing techniques, taking care of any emotional, mental trauma or stresses in your life.
Yeah.
So it's a comprehensive approach. It's not just about breathing.
No, but I think you're right. It's a bit of a gateway, isn't it, to other things. When you start to think about the breath, you think about sleep quite naturally. And then, yeah, because you're right. If you have that bad night's sleep, you're just craving terrible food the next day, aren't you? It's a really hard thing to come across. I wanted to ask you, I've got one last question for you. And it's a bit, it probably isn't your field, but it just fits into sleep. So I wanted to see if you knew anything about it, which was the effects of grounding. I don't know if you've come across this, grounding yourself and sleep. So there was a documentary recently I saw, I think it is just called The Grounding Documentary, about just spending a few minutes with your bare feet on the grass. And then they looked at kind of the blood samples, and they could see things were moving a bit more freely and the inflammation started to drop. And then they also talked about having a grounding mat on your bed. And then that's kind of got a route back into the earth. So I don't know, again, it might be nothing to do with your area at all, but I wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
I've heard about it. I've read some of the studies on it a long time ago. And I mean, at that time, I thought that was interesting and it makes sense. But it kind of goes along with this general principle of getting back to your roots, like natural foods, getting back to nature. Because everything we do, technology in modern life, put barriers between us and nature.
Yeah.
So it kind of makes sense. And that also kind of leads you into the whole electromagnetic fields theories and all the negative detrimental health effects of electricity and magnetism and all the electromagnetic fields.
Yes.
Now,
yeah.
That's a whole other
issue. Thing. Having your Wi-Fi router on near your head, near bed and all that good stuff. Yeah, there's a lot of problems there. Yeah.
You're very paranoid, but yeah. There's some truth to some of
yeah, no, it's scary stuff. Dr. Park, just before we close then, it's been so wonderful to get your expertise and your thoughts on breathing. Are there any other bits that we didn't cover that you wanted to talk about?
Well, I'm not an expert in nutrition and diet, but that area of people trying to lose weight and all the metabolic syndromes that's exploding right now, sleep is intimately related to it. And a lot of people, one of the reasons why they can't lose weight, no matter how much they exercise, eat cleanly, is that they're not breathing properly at night. Because all these things that we talked about, you can control during the daytime. You can exercise, eat healthy, do all the exercises, but you have no control when you're breathing at night. And I just have the advantage of being able to see what's happening when they're sleeping in the operating room. And it's shocking how many people have breathing problems that don't manifest a sleep apnea. So just think about it. If you're not making any progress in your health journey, think about seeing an ENT or even a sleep doctor to kind of look at that possibility that you may have a sleep breathing problem.
Yeah.
And even if they say you don't have sleep apnea, take it with a grain of salt and follow all these steps. All these steps we talked about kind of addresses it for the most part, partially, if not completely, but to various degrees. So I have this informal rule where if I recommend something really conservatively, about a quarter will find significant relief, a quarter will find some relief, a quarter will find minimal relief, and a quarter will find no relief, which is the case for most medical therapies out there.
The sleep apnea thing's a scary one, because I would say, I don't have sleep apnea, but I go for a wee every night. And sometimes I've gone 6 hours without a drink before bed. I was like, right, I'm not going to have anything 6 hours before I go to sleep, not even a sip of water. Still went for a wee in the middle of the night. So you've made me think that I'm going to try opening up the nostrils and I'm going to go back to mouth taping again, because I tried it a couple of times. I thought, I don't think I'm a mouth breather, but then you don't know, do you? I guess that's the problem, isn't
right.
it? Yeah.
But they've actually shown that nighttime urination is just as predictive of predicting sleep apnea as is snoring.
Wow. Okay. Right. Very interesting. Completely anecdotal and makes probably no connection to it at all. But I noticed when I was doing, have you heard of Athletic Greens? It's like it's a supplement. You find a lot of kind of people like Joe Rogan and Tim Ferriss and those sort of people that they really love it. I noticed when I was taking those greens, the nighttime wee and had stopped. So I wondered if there was a nutritional thing. Anyway, that was just me rambling on about something, but I found that quite interesting. Need to get back to those greens. Dr. Park, so where can people find you? Where can they get your book? Where can we direct them to now if they want to learn more?
My book is on Amazon called Sleep Interrupted. And my website is drstevenpark.com, drstevenpark. And if you want a free ebook called Unstuffing Your Stuffy Nose, go to my website, drstevenpark.com/unstuffyourstuffynose.
Wonderful. So guys, the links are below now in the description. Go and get the book. Go and get onto the website and get that free ebook and look at the other book. And Dr. Park, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. So thank you so much for your time. And I hope to see you again on here. We'll try and convince you to come back again another time to talk a bit more. But for now, thank you so much. And guys, thank you so much for watching. And we'll see you all on the next Breathcast. Thank you, everyone. Cheers, Dr. Park.
Bye-bye. My pleasure.
Well, thank you for watching that podcast with Dr. Stephen Park. I hope you took some notes. You can obviously go back and watch that or listen to that anytime that you wish. As a reminder, down below is links to his website and his 5 ways to unblock a stuffy nose. He's a good person just to follow on Instagram as well. He put some really interesting pictures on there. So have a look at that. If you've stuck all the way through to the end, then you're clearly a true fan of breathwork and breathing. So congratulations to you. Just as a reminder, the free functional breathing essentials PDF link is down below. And you might have already heard me talk about the level 1 functional breathing course. And if you're on the fence about that, have a look. Just read some of the stuff that's on there. Have a look at some of the testimonials. You know, I feel really blessed that people have paid money and given their time to go on and do this breathing course. And some of the stuff that I hear back is, you know, it's lovely to hear how it's affecting people's lives. So if you're interested in knowing more about my course, I would be honoured if you would consider me to be your digital breathwork coach. And together, I'll guide you through very simple, but stuff that we don't learn in school. Simple techniques, exercises. You know, I get to have these podcasts with people like Dr. Stephen Park. And again, you'd be mad if you didn't see the same things coming up over and over again. But what I've been able to do is take, you know, 5 years worth of doing the breathing and reading about the breathing and 50 plus hours of podcasts and put that into something simple, because you can go out there, can't you? And you can find all these different things on free podcasts and blah, blah, blah. But actually time's precious. And so what I've done here is just taken it, condensed it into something really manageable, something that you have forever. And you can kind of learn it, do the homework, download the PDFs, ask me questions, ask the community questions. That's all in there as well. So if you're interested in that, have a look down below. We've got different payment options. You can pay monthly for it, or you can pay it all in one go and get access to everything straight away. And I hope to see you on the Breathwork course. There's other Breathcasts on the channel, and you might want to listen to this, or you might want to watch this. And I will finish yabbering on now and say have a great day, have a great breath, and I'll see you on the next video. Cheers.